Well, good evening to each one that's here tonight. I pray that we can have a good evening together. Why don't we start our worship with two songs? Let's see.
Oh,
This evening, for a few verses, let's turn to Ephesians, or 2 Timothy chapter. Sorry, I got my notes mixed up here, as you can hear. Romans chapter 8, verse 35. The topic tonight will be on a book called Under His Wings. And I think it's about a missionary. I didn't read it myself, so I'm looking forward to learning some stuff about that. And I'm not sure what all LaVon is sharing, but I thought of one thing that each of us, even if we aren't missionaries, we can each experience the love of God, and that's one of the reasons that, that's the reason that we do have missionaries. Let's begin reading in verse 35, Romans chapter 8. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? As it is written, for thy sake we are killed all the day long. We are accounted as sheep for the slaughter. Nay, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him that loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. And that is a wonderful thing. Only as Christians can experience or know what that is like. And that in itself should be enough, should be reason to tell other people about him. And so I think we'll be hearing more about that in the topic later, maybe about God's protection as well. And so we'll look forward to that. Let's also go to, there's a verse in 2 Timothy chapter 3 that I had to think of Paul. He was a great missionary in his day, and 2 Timothy chapter 3 verse 11 says, verse 10, but thou hast fully known my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, charity, and patience, persecutions, afflictions, which came up unto me at Antioch and at Iconium, at Lystra, what persecutions I endured, but out of them all the Lord delivered me. And so, if we do know God and we are doing his will, he will protect us. And that's I think Paul was a great example of serving God as a missionary. And there's a few more verses about Paul I had to think of in Acts chapter 5. Verse 17. It's just one example of God's protection of one of his servants, of Paul, when he was doing the Lord's work. Acts chapter 5, verse 17. Then the high priest rose up, and all they that were with him, which is the sect of the Sadducees, and were filled with indignation, and laid their hands on the apostles and put them in the common prison. But the angel of the Lord by night opened the prison doors and brought them forth and said, go stand and speak in the temple to the people and all people all the words of this life. And so you can see the reason that the angel opened the doors for them was so that they could go spread, tell more people about the words of life and God's love. And Let's go to verse 26 of the same chapter. Then went the captain with the officers and brought them without violence, for they feared the people, lest they should have been stoned. When they had brought them, they set them before the council, and the high priest asked them, saying, "Did we not straitly command you that ye should not teach in this name? And behold, ye have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine, and intend to bring this man's blood upon us." Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, "We ought to obey God rather than men. The God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom ye slew and hanged on a tree. Him hath God exalted with his right hand to be a prince and a savior, for to give repentance to Israel and forgiveness of sins. And we are his witnesses of these things, and so is also the Holy Ghost, whom God hath given to them that obey him." So we see in verse 29 that we ought to obey God rather than men, because he is our creator, and he is the one that gives that love to us. So why don't we, I'll take your prayer requests at this time.
Good evening and greetings in Christ. The book I was asked to share on was written by Yuri Sharp and also had help from his daughter, Dorcas Sharp Hoover, who wrote Awaiting the Dawn. And the story takes place in Guatemala. This was written for MAM's, which is Mennonite Air Mission's 30th anniversary. So, I don't know, I read this book and took notes along the way and tried to capture the sort of the essence of it. I sometimes got bogged down in details, and I don't know, I just want to give a feel of some through particular stories and some through details of the place, or some of the places, just to give, to add a little color to the difficulty that the missionaries faced there. Yeah.
Are you suggesting that this is an overview of the 30 years of their ministry?
Not really. It's more of a... Okay, basically, it ends up... The book has most to do with one town that was reached. But there's different... Not everything tonight will be directly related to that one town, but the majority of it will be. And not everything is in order as it happened exactly. I tried to do that a bit, but I don't think it's all that way. But I think we'll have the general idea on some of those things there. Just a little history on Mennonite Air Missions. They were established in 1972. In February of that year, they bought a property in Guatemala City, and Harold and Darlene Kaufman, does anyone here know where they were from?
Wisconsin,
okay. They moved there and began holding services. Then MAM purchased a small airplane that was designed for taking off on short airstrips, I guess landing too. And Harold took flight training. I wish I knew how old he was at this point. David, do you have an idea on that? Or?
I guess.
Okay. Hello?
I don't really have an answer to that, but maybe you're too young. Harold Kaufman, but you're here a couple times. Okay. Over here. I'm sure he'll listen to some of the stories of one story about an airplane and a landing strip in a cornfield that airplane didn't quite get compressed to the landing strip.
Okay. Very good. I wish she could be here tonight to tell us firsthand. But there, the theme verse or the motto of MAM was Psalm 126:5-6. "They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. He that goeth forth and weepeth, bearing precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him." Their goal was to reach remote villages in the heartland of Guatemala, especially to establish indigenous churches with native leaders. And could someone help me out on indigenous? It's a word we hear, but I should have looked it up myself. But Joel. Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, thank you for that. Harold Kaufman's burning desire was to give wings to the gospel. The thing of farms and wealth and occupation didn't hold the attraction that I think it does for most of us, probably. That was just his. That came through different times. He just basically gave himself for the people of Guatemala. The first outpost was established in San Andres, and in 1973 they began looking for their second outreach, and that sort of challenged me too. Possibly within a year, or at least in the next year, they were looking for the second place they could reach. So they had a time of prayer, and I don't know what all went into that, but praying and looking at the map, and they kept coming back to this certain region, and he just kept coming back to a dot on the map, which was in the department of Quiche. I'm not sure how to say all these Spanish words, but the town called, maybe I'll let Lowell say it first, right? What was the?
San Bartolome.
I'd probably just call it SB. So SB is the main place we're talking about tonight. And that's what most of this book is about, is the search for the scouting and the development of that church and some of the trials they went through. The people there were Indians with Mayan blood. Their ancestors were by nature warm and hospitable, but were also a very powerful nation. They were overcome, over 400 years ago, by Spaniards, and they were misused terribly and basically fled to the highlands, to the remote places in the mountains to start over, I guess. Their ancestors also worship the sun in massive pyramid temples. So they obviously were skilled people. They had some terrible pagan worship. That was the ancestors. By this time, I think the human sacrifice had pretty much been replaced by other things. But they did things even like ripping beating hearts from chosen youth to sacrifice. Just unbelievable. But the people at SB there were definitely deep in sorcery and superstition, sort of a mixture of Catholicism and paganism. A lot of rumors going around there. Ever since they were conquered by the Spaniards, they were very suspicious of change and foreigners, and they just wanted to keep things the way they had them in their culture. They had rumors like white men plant the head of an Indian child under every electric pole that he puts up. And so this is what they were up against. Also, the territory basically had no laws, except their behavior was dictated by the Catholic priests, by the witch doctors, and by guerrillas, at least eventually. So the priests and the witch doctors got money in return for hopefully favor and blessing and good crops. The Catholic Church would have fiestas there in town, which involved frenzied music, dancing, firecrackers, and drunkenness, fighting. And they also prayed around life-sized images of saints. SB was beyond the end of the road, at least at the time they were doing their scouting. It was on a plateau in the mountains, surrounded by deep ravines and mountainous ridges. The houses were adobe houses, and I believe they were some of them were whitewashed. Just mud brick houses and mostly dirt streets, although some possibly cobblestone. And around the village, they had their plots of corn and vegetables. There was no running water and no electricity, which isn't terribly hard for some of you to imagine, but probably more for some of us younger ones. They did have a telegraph office. Their water source was rather deplorable. They had a murky mud hole that the animals and the people shared. And probably as a result of some of that, or at least would have affected it, was the high infant mortality rate. I think it was one of the highest, had been one of the highest in the world at 85%. Well, 85% of the babies died before five, so I'm not sure what the official infant mortality rate, you know, what ages that catches, but they had if they wanted fresh water, they had to hike down to the ravine for 2 kilometers. So I suppose that's why the mud hole sufficed for most of them. A lot of the mothers were too malnourished to feed their babies, so they gave them cornstarch water. And the traditional home remedy for diaper rash was cow manure. So that may work. I heard stories, I guess, about that wasn't used in that way, but possibly has some more value than we usually give it. Yeah. Harold was a challenge to me. It seemed like he just had some basic premises that he worked from. Once they prayed and studied the map, he just became convinced that they should look into it. He said, you know, whether or not we're welcome, I think we should look into it. He also deeply felt that anyone in God's will is safe in the protection of his wings. And that is sort of one of the capstones of this book. Harold was a calm man, not known to panic quickly. When he was in Guatemala City, not sure how long he had been there, but he went to the bank to pick up $2,000 that they had wired him. Well, he tried to casually stick it in his pockets. He was not really comfortable with that. It happened to be about 2.5-inch thick wad of bills. So he put it in his pockets and strolled out of the bank. Had a few more errands in town. He's at the parts store, the auto parts store, and they weren't quite open again, I suppose, after lunch break or a siesta. So he had that 10 minutes to wait. He reached back to recline his seat, and his door flew open. And here was a man with a pistol, shoved that in his face, and put a hand into his pocket. So Harold... I don't know what went through his mind, but Harold pivoted toward the robber and discreetly leaned his right elbow on the horn. And the man startled and jerked, which the pistol fired into the rocker panel. That was Harold, not too quickly rattled. For the scouting part, they had this place called SB, in our words, that they were going to go explore to see if there's a way to reach this remote village. So the native nurse that was training there in the city hopped into their Toyota Land Cruiser with Harold. It was a 66 Land Cruiser that was four-wheel drive. And they went as far as they could, and there were different roads leading off. And so which road leads to SB? So they asked, asked someone who told him which road, but he said rather menacingly that foreigners and strangers aren't welcome there. Angel, the nursing student, got rather uneasy with that, and just read Harold's response to him. "Don't you remember the sense of peace we had the other night after praying and looking at the map? We'll put our trust in the Lord and take one step of faith at a time. Let's see what God will do for us." And so they went on. The road climbed up the steep face of a mountain, and it ended where the bulldozer had stopped. So I guess that was, maybe that's reading too much into it. I just assumed that's where the building had stopped. Either that or a bulldozer was in the way. Whatever, that was the end of the road. From there, they asked again, "Where is SB?" And a man, I think more, a little friendlier than the last, said, "It's over there. It's not far." But it was basically downhill, at times quite rough and steep. I think Harold felt like his leg brakes had given out by the time they got there. But they walked into town, and the streets were strangely empty. So they, it was a little, made them a little uneasy. And finally they met someone that was a school teacher in the public school there that was not from that region, but had come in to teach. And they had a helpful chat with him. And one, the school teacher, just didn't think, he told them some of the darkness there. And when they asked him if there is an evangelical witness, and he explained a little bit how dark it is with the Catholicism and paganism there, which they were well aware of. But basically that was their only contact there. People were watching, and a man called Jose, which is about 20 at the time, fingered his machete and was wondering just why doesn't someone run him out or kill him? So they decided, basically they made it back safely to their Toyota and went back to the city. Decided someone should go back that knows their language. They would have spoken Spanish, and I mean the Harold Kaufman and this other man accompanying him. They decided they'll send someone that knows the Indian language. So two native men were chosen and were flown there in a Mission Aviation Fellowship plane, which Harold hadn't had enough flight experience to do the crazy landings and takeoffs yet, so they were getting help from Mission Aviation Fellowship. Pilot dropped him off and had other things he needed to see after. So the two men were just on their own in this strange place, a hostile place. So they walked into town, and of course, imagine an airplane landing in this remote village where something like that was just, I'm not sure what we'd think, I guess, I think it'd be considered quite an evasion. But the mayor allowed them to stay with him, fed him, and of course the mayor here was not as influential as say, the Catholic priest or the witch doctor, those kind of men. So, but it was still a good sign. The plane had saved the scouts a 5-hour hike and turned it into a 5-minute ride. Most of the people just ignored them, wouldn't talk to them. They slept with the mayor in the mayor's house for the night safely. Next morning they went out into the streets and all the shops were closed, and they were wondering, well, they just didn't feel welcome. And they were needing to go. They were supposed to be picked up the next afternoon. Well, they saw this commotion out where the plane had landed and discovered that the natives were hoeing up the grassy strip. So they sent a telegram message to Guatemala City and then managed to get back to their city. They weren't based out of Guatemala City then, but a closer city. They had paid a guide to take them back, which is maybe still amazing that they could find someone that was willing to take them on that 5-hour hike. So with the hospitality of the mayor, you know, it felt like not every door was closed. And they prayed again and decided that they had a qualified couple that could go. A native named Victor and his wife Anita, which was from Pennsylvania. And they had a baby. So here they go into this village with their little baby. And particularly for the wife, Anita, they said that only one other village woman knew Spanish. So here she's English, knew Spanish, but then only one other woman knew Spanish, and the rest would speak the Indian language. Victor spoke English and Spanish, the Indian language, a little French, and a little bit of Pennsylvania Dutch. But he was a man suited for the job, but a man of much prayer and a very humble man, serving man. They were willing to go, so the two native scouts returned to find a house, see if they could find a house to rent there at SB. And Harold reminded them of Matthew 7:7, to ask, seek, and to knock, and to pray as they go. There you see Harold's faith coming through again in that. Harold and that mission aviation pilot flew back in to look for another landing strip since the first one was destroyed. And as Lowell was saying, they had a run-in with the cornfield. They found a level spot. It was there's a lot of water around at the time. But they found a level spot, and there was a cornfield at the end and a ravine after the cornfield. Well, it happened that they were just sliding after they hit the ground and saw they weren't going to stop. So they gave it full throttle again and hopefully were going to clear the corn, but didn't. So they just, the propeller was chopping corn and the wings were taking some along with it. But they lifted off again. So they lightened their load and came back, landed properly, and paid the angry farmer to make up for the lost corn. But through that, we're able to secure that as they got permission to land there in the future. So Victor and Anita moved to SB. One of the rumors going around right at the start, or a rumor, was that Victor rode around on his motorcycle at night and nabbed babies. So that, just a difficulty there. But his joy and radiance got their attention. And it was only after they were there several months that the mayor's son and his wife were converted. I just found that amazing to think of the generations of darkness and then the light coming that soon. Victor had a dream of which God told him four things that were necessary for success. The first one was a life of complete consecration. Second, a life of Bible reading. The third, a life of fasting. Fourth, a life of much prayer. So those were sort of Victor's keys to in his mission. Anita, his wife, would often wake up and find him missing from bed. or not missing from bed, but she'd hear him praying during the night. And he was often missing from his spot at the table because he was fasting. Something I thought was interesting was the mission well. They had a well dug, I think mostly by the natives there. It was hand dug, 4 feet wide. They dug for 3 months. We're at 180 feet, and there was no water. And the Christians were really praying for water. That was one of Victor's earnest prayers. He just believed that they would find water. And when they were at 200 feet, the rope snapped, and a man fell, caught himself, and fell again, caught himself, and was rescued by a rope. And at 7 months, they were 300 feet deep, still no water. There were Christians praying in Guatemala City, in the U.S., in nearby San Andres. And finally, at 325 feet, they hit water. So this is one of the things that is a little bit out of place in sequence here. But the man that was fingering the machete when he first saw them come, he was the one that did the final digging way underneath to dig out sand, probably one of the most dangerous parts of it, since it was just a hole in the ground. There's nothing to protect from caving in. One of the big things for Guatemala was the earthquake in 1976. I can't remember that, obviously. At one place, it was 7.9 on the Richter scale and lasted 39 seconds. There was just tremendous destruction. There was 22,000 killed in Guatemala, but none were killed in SB. There were 75,000 injured and 30,000 orphaned and 1 million homeless. There were about 300 villages destroyed. And 2 days later, there was the second earthquake that had a 5.7 on the Richter scale. So there was a lot of terror, and there were people that came to the Lord as a result of that as well. Some people walked 15 miles across the mountain to church, which was a four-hour hike for them. Just before the earthquake, it was 2 days before it happened, Harold felt moved to withdraw $500 from the bank, which ended up being that was very useful for medical supplies and things and fuel after the earthquake. Just a side note on the corruption there. It was said that the first foreign aid that came to Guatemala was used to repair their main beer factory. So that was, I guess, priority number one. Okay, they came in, that would have been 1972, 73, and in 1976, a former witch doctor accepted Christ. Something Harold pointed out when he checked back in with them, he shepherded numerous churches from his base in Guatemala City. He would fly supplies out and check up on them. And one of his usual questions was how's the flock? Or how are the sheep doing? And that was a challenge to me too. It seemed to be a big concern whenever they got back together. On one of those visits, he told them that good things and opposition often go together. And some of the strongest opposition would likely turn to be their biggest support too. Which Victor prayed a lot for Miguel Tum. He was a 90-year-old man that was a short man and a real fireball. One of the stronger oppositions to them coming, as well as the 20-year-old Jose that later helped them dig the well. And this man was an inspiration to me. After his conversion, he hiked. It was 10 miles. He hiked to the top of a mountain several times to witness to his brother. So there was, in 1977, that was two of their strongest opponents softening. This Jose that was fingering his machete, he also was converted. His habit of beer and cigarettes stopped, and his wife was very angry with him for his for going to the evangelical church. Threatened to stop cooking for him, but she also softened and became a Christian. It was just a week later that Jose's brother became a Christian, and his mom basically kicked him out. But then later on, she also became a Christian. In 78, there was quite a bit of political unrest, and I don't know what all went into that. Some of the professors in Marxist professors, I think, were stirring up just sort of the bottled up frustrations of the lower and the middle class, and there were threats of communist takeover. In Guatemala City, there were 50 buses burned in 2 days, and that was because fare had gone up 10 cents. So just a really a situation of unrest. In 79, the guerrilla gangs were forming in the hills. Something Victor said, Victor was the native that had gone, that had first gone to SB to establish a church there. His testimony with the threat of guerrillas was, quote, "I'm ready for them when they come. I'll open the door, and in my friendliest voice, I'll say, 'Good evening, what can I do for you?' I'll be as warm and as polite as I can be. I'm not afraid, because even in this dark night, we are under the shadow of his wings." Just a real trust in the Lord. Later, they did end up moving to Guatemala City for their safety, and for their and they managed a mission headquarters after the American missionaries had to evacuate. Victor had a very narrow escape around a roadblock. This was before they went to the city. Saw a tree laying across the road and knew that this was likely a guerrilla activity. Saw just enough space for the pickup to go around the side, so he gunned it. And his wife pushed the children onto the floor and ducked down. And, of course, after they got around, there was a spray of bullets. Just one hit the truck, and they were all safe. Just one of the many times that God's hand seemed to be especially over the church at SB. There's a lot of pressure to take part in the civil patrol against the guerrillas for the church people. And especially the more lukewarm members did fall away with that pressure. And there was different of those men that ended up having gruesome deaths at the hands of the guerrillas because they had joined up in a more political way, left the church and were more active politically. SB became known as a town of widows. There's just a lot of... The guerrillas were attracted to the highlands there because they were left alone a lot more. There's a story I like to read about Jose when he was led into a death trap. Jose became... he used to be the president of the Catholic Church there in SB and then had become a Christian and was also a leader then in the church there. Just read his experience. Let's see. this is an experience he had in a nearby town. I don't think that would have been right. Well, actually, I'm not sure on that. I'll just read here. "Hey, you," the merchant jabbed a finger at Jose's startled face. "Where's that money you promised me for those pipe fittings, you good-for-nothing Christian? You promised payment several days ago. Now where's the money?" "I wish I knew," Jose thought, recalling the kind engineer's promise to cover the fee for the pipe fittings to ensure that the town would have running water. The engineer was a man of his word, but the money just hadn't come yet. And now the merchant holding the bill had accosted Jose on the streets of Santa Cruz. "You'll be paid," Jose calmly assured the irate merchant. "We expect the money any day. I promise you'll be paid. In fact, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll pay you an extra 10% for your trouble." "Yeah, all right. You'll go with me to a lawyer's office. That's what you'll do. And you'll sign an official statement telling the exact date you'll pay," the man spat. "I know all about you deceitful evangelicals. I tell you, I'm a devout Catholic, and I won't stand for you deceiving the people with that Bible of yours. I hate that book." Pedestrians stopped to stare at the odd pair, the ranting merchant with his shrieks and wild gestures, alongside his quiet counterpart. It seemed strange for the businessman to suddenly explode over the bill. He had known the engineer would be covering the account. Why was he so furious over a few days' delay? "You must stop this deception," the attacker shouted, shoving Jose through a doorway. We're going to see that it ends." Looking around him, Jose's heart began to pound. "This is no lawyer's office. Have I walked into a trap? Lord, help me." "So you've come. Hallelujah!" a stranger sneered as he sauntered into the room. "I've been waiting for you," he added significantly. Jose shuddered at the blasphemy and filth that spewed from the stranger's mouth. "This is no lawyer's office," Jose realized in horror. "I've walked into a gorilla's den." A chill crept up the young captive's spine. "Lord, help me. They are going to kill me." Terrorists played no games. Like cats, they might torment a captured mouse for a time, but the final outcome was always the same. Life held little value for these ruthless revolutionaries. As the men swore at Jose and his church, calling him a deceiver and many worse names, Jose's mind seemed to freeze. If only he could explain to them. Ah, there were the tracks he always carried in his pocket. Perhaps the men would accept those better than a personal explanation of his beliefs. Selecting several, he handed them to his captors. "Here, these papers will help you understand our beliefs." His smiling face and gentle voice contrasted starkly with the rage and hatred of the merchant and his comrade. "Bah! I'll show you what we think of your papers, you liar." The stranger snapped the pamphlets and ripped them to shreds. "Sirs, you'll get your money. As a Christian, I cannot lie," Jose continued quietly. "The Bible teaches us to speak truthfully. As a Christian, I assure you, we will pay everything we owe." His hands trembled as he lifted his Bible from the shoulder bag that he carried with him everywhere. What a comforting reminder that he did not face these men alone. Lovingly, he paged through the scriptures, searching for an appropriate verse to read to his attackers. He did not see the hand that flashed out until his precious Bible was ripped from his hands and flung to the floor. The brute shook his fist in Jose's face. "I'll show you a thing or two, you deceiver." Grabbing Jose by the shoulders, he shook him until his teeth rattled. Jose's heart cried out to God, "Lord, help me be faithful. If my time has come to die, receive my spirit." Suddenly, Jose realized that this was not about money at all, but only a guise to get him into the clutches of the guerrillas. The real issue, he began to see, was his non-resistant stand as a leader in the community. If he could be disposed of, perhaps the guerrillas could persuade more villagers to join their cause. If an unpaid bill were the issue, a businessman might show mercy. But terrorists didn't know the meaning of the word. As the attacker released Jose, the pastor fell to his knees and softly began to sing a song which he expected to be his dying prayer. "I'm trusting, Lord, in thee. Thou art faithful, Lord, so faithful to me. Ne'er hast thou forsaken me. Even though I'm weak, I'm trusting, Lord, in thee." As the song filled the room, a powerful wind began to blow until the entire building shook and shuddered. Hailstones pelted the building like a volley of bullets. Jose's captors froze, their cruel, glaring eyes widened in terror. In a flash, the terrorists were out the door. Jose was left alone, kneeling in awe, reverence, and worship. The oppressing sense of evil was gone, and Hosea's heart overflowed with wonder in the sweet, comforting presence of the Lord. That was one of the stories that just really touched me and just made me want to bless the Lord for his power. I don't know if I'll have time to read several others. MAM, Men on Air Missions, had a policy to leave at the request of the American Embassy. And in September of 1981, John Troyer was martyred. That'd be the one in the book Awaiting the Dawn. And with that, all the missionaries were evacuated. At that point, or around that time, there was 175 natives attending the church at SB. I just thought that was so amazing. It was a terribly hard time to be part of the church. Well, maybe even harder to be part of the political scene, but especially pastors, leaders were targeted by the guerrillas. But they had 175 attending at that point. And at that time, Jose was the leader here at the church because Victor had moved to the city, and he needed help, so they ordained two deacons. And the one deacon, just shortly, or not terribly long after he was ordained, had some men come to him offering him a job. And yeah, I won't read it, but I'll just try to recap a little bit. It just stood out to me how he so freely talked to the men and questioned them out on he asked, what are the tools of your trade? And they were saying that they'll if he helps them, they'll help him. They'll take from... But what they were doing, were taking from the rich and giving to the poor. So the deacon, Bartolo, realized that this is probably not a business offer. He needed the money desperately, but was realizing that they were part of the guerrillas. So he just took the opportunity to witness to them, and he was shot. Maybe I can just find that again on the... I'll read a little bit. What they had done at that point was they left him. They let him off the hook. I mean, they were getting irate with him because of his straightforwardness. But they said they'll be back in 15 days, and they were. After he was shot, he had collapsed there, and he saw the gunman take aim again to finish his work, and then he sensed someone was kneeling beside him, and I'll just read here. He blinked and looked again. A sensation of awe surged through the young deacon as he gazed at the scene in front of his eyes. He could see a man in the whitest robe kneeling over him. Yes, it was Jesus himself. Bartolo's tense, wounded body relaxed as he heard Jesus' soothing words wash over him. Son, do not fear because I am with you. You are blessed for you are doing my will. With a flash of fire, the gun blasted into the night. Bartolo's eyes grew large with amazement as he saw Jesus blow against the charge, causing the pellets to drop harmlessly to the ground. With shrieks of terror, the men fell over each other in a frightened stampede to escape. Had they too seen the figure in white blow the pellets away from their target? Suddenly, it was deathly still except for the barking of dogs down in the valley, away from the town, marking the trail of the fleeing mob. And he survived that. Another marvelous protection of God over him, and something that his attackers obviously saw, the presence of Jesus as well. As he was laying unconscious, he saw a vision of Jesus standing at his side. I'll just read here again. As Bartholomew lay unconscious, he saw a vision of Jesus standing at his side, taking his hand. He felt himself being lifted above the house and over SB. Below, he saw villages, mountains, and he saw souls sinking into Christless graves. "My son," Jesus whispered lovingly, "I have work for you to do. I am sparing your life so that you can be a witness for me." So yeah, just rather amazing. Something to the effect of John Troyer's death. One of the neat things about that was how MAM's goal for having Native leadership was realized through that, because all the missionaries pulled out sooner than they would have thought would be helpful. But through that, the church just flourished, and the Native pastors had a way of leading their churches that was really strengthening. I'd like to read just a little bit about that 90-year-old man that became a Christian. He died when he was, I think, about 95. And just before his death, I'll read what he saw. "Men in white robes are going in and out of my house. The men in long robes gather around my bed all night. I asked them, 'Why did you come? If you have come for me and you have my father's permission to take me, I'm ready and I'll go.'" And several days later, he was taken to heaven. Just thought that was another neat touch of the Lord on the church at SB. There was one other story that stood out to me. That was when Jose and the town mayor were on the way back to another town, traveling the road that no one traveled unless it was pretty urgent because of the guerrilla activity. And Jose, basically the mayor came to him and said, "You need to go to town with me to sign papers." It had to do with the town getting water, and Jose was quite involved with that. And the mayor had at one point been a part of the church and had fallen away. And on the way back, there was a truckload of, I think it was either 9 or 12 men in a truck. They came back from the town to their home village there at SB. And on the way back, the guerrillas had set a trap with dynamite. I might just read a part of that story as well. One neat aspect of the story, too, was that on the way home, Jose felt moved to ride in the cab, along with the driver and one other passenger, which is probably why he survived the attack. Hidden behind the bank, the terrorist band heard the approaching vehicle. Ah, the truck was coming at last. The previous day, the gang had watched the truck leave SB, and they knew it would return. Feeling confident that the cattle truck was the only vehicle that would dare to travel this hazardous stretch, the guerrillas made their plans and set the trap. While the 11 men on the truck went about their business in Santa Cruz, the guerrillas carefully planted dynamite in the roadbed and into the left bank. When they heard the whine of the truck cresting the top of the mountain ridge, every man flew into position, tensed and poised for action. Jose studied the distant village. "I wonder if Victor has finished interviews," he asked himself. "I hope, Suddenly, a deafening explosion blasted the truck into the air. A cloud of smoke, dirt, and debris hovered overhead, and then rained rocks, shards of glass, dirt, dismembered body parts, and metal fragments down on the remains of the mangled truck. Then all was still, deathly still. At SB, the village buzzed with last-minute preparations for the weddings, Thanksgiving service, and for the big celebration when the boom echoed from mountain to mountain. Every eye turned toward the mountain and the telltale cloud of dynamite smoke. Momentarily paralyzed in the grip of horror, every villager knew without being told that the cattle truck had been sabotaged. "The mayor," someone shouted. "Jose, no, no, no! God help us!" The village was filled with the anguished screams and wails of women. "Let's go," several men shouted. Grabbing sheets of tin roofing to serve as stretchers, fathers, brothers, and sons of the passengers dashed toward the drifting cloud of smoke and debris. Women paced the streets, weeping and praying. "Is it safe for the men to go?" some asked anxiously. But others argued that the wounded cannot be left on the mountain, could not be left to die on the mountain. A deathly silence reigned at the scene of the disaster. Jose felt as though someone had battered his jaw and shoulder with a tree limb. The smoke stung his nostrils. His face and shoulder throbbed with pain. "I'm alive," he murmured in disbelief as he gingerly touched his bloody mouth, shredded by shrapnel. "Satan tried to destroy me, but I'm alive," he thought. In a daze, Jose grabbed his Bible, which accompanied him everywhere, and tried the door latch. It opened and he tumbled out. The driver and the other passenger crawled out behind him. Dropping to his knees, the pastor supported his bleeding, mutilated jaw with his hand as he murmured what he knew could be his last prayer. Any moment, the guerrillas would leap out from behind the rocks to finish off the survivors, Jose knew. That was the way they operated. While the young man was praying earnestly for his family and his precious flock, the terrorists dashed from behind the bank, their machine guns trained on the three survivors. Suddenly, the masked gunmen skidded to a stop, a look of terror filling their faces. Turning, they fled wildly in the direction they had come. Jose gazed in disbelief as the terrorists stumbled over rocks in their haste to escape. What had the men seen that had terrified them so? Shining, sword-drawn angels? Glowing wings? Didn't the scriptures say, "The Lord shall cause thine enemies that rise up against thee to be smitten before thy face? They shall come out against thee one way, and flee before thee seven ways"? I'll stop reading there. Basically, the rest, all the men on the back of the truck were killed, and Jose also ended up recovering. There was some that impressed me with going through that. His prayer after that, as he was recovering in the hospital, just like to read that. "Lord," Jose prayed, "I'm yours. If I can be of any use to you, please use me and guard my soul in these perilous times." That spoke to me, his prayer to guard his soul. And here his body was just endangered, greatly endangered. And he's thinking mostly, you know, "Help me to be faithful to the end. I want to be of use to you." Well, it's time to pass time to wrap it up. In 1981 and 82, in the village there, there were 148 men killed, which is, I suppose, why it got its became known as the as a place of widows. But there were no Christians killed in all that terrorist activity. But the men who had backslid, they're different of those that suffered violent death. And I guess we'd agree that God doesn't always protect Christians in that way, but it just seems like that was like God was holding this little village under his wings. I don't know how to conclude, really. I guess just seeing the vision and the calling of Harold and others, of the church leader, the native church leaders, they had They had the calling and vision. They just spent a lot of time praying. Just had intense prayer and abandoned their lives, basically. Although they did, different of them moved out when the risk got, or when they knew there was a threat on their life. And then just the work of His Spirit, softening hearts that had been hard for generations. And one of the biggest things, too, is just God's protection over His people. The way that we can put our trust in God, no matter what the outcome is, just knowing that He is in control and seeing His faithfulness in the past. So there's, I guess, my rendition of Under His Wings. Just a very, very worthwhile book if you have time to absorb it sometime and catch more of the feel of that and the details. I'd really encourage that.
Thank you very much, Milan, for your time. It was very interesting. Why don't we stand for a closing prayer, and maybe Brian can lead us in prayer.